Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Thursday, May 30th, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Trump guilty on all 34 counts. In Boise courtroom, Chad Daybell guilty on all counts, including murder. Middle-aged white men harass Native American children on a field trip in downtown Coeur d'Alene. U.S. Republican Senator Steve Baines of Montana blocks federal nomination of first Native American federal judge that would serve in Montana. Percent of out-of-state abortions in Washington increases since Trump Supreme Court Dobbs decision. A new police chief in Seattle. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. But first, world headlines from Feature Story News, the Pacifica Radio Network, and the Public News Service.
Jurors in Donald Trump's New York hush money trial today found the former president guilty on all 34 counts of falsifying business records to cover up an alleged affair with adult film actress Stormy Daniels. Trump is the first former president convicted of felony crimes. Ed Donahue has more.
The reaction outside court? It took the jury only 2 days to reach the verdicts for falsifying business records in a scheme to illegally influence the 2016 election through hush money payments. There is the possibility Trump could face prison time as he is trying to return to the White House.
We'll keep fighting. We'll fight till the end and we'll win because our country's gone to hell. We don't have the same country anymore. We have a divided mess.
The falsifying business records charges carry up to 4 years behind bars, but prosecutors have not said whether they intend to push for prison time.
This is long from over. Thank you very much.
I'm Ed Donahue.
The presumptive Republican presidential candidate has been convicted of falsifying business records to cover up a sex scandal ahead of the 2016 election. From outside the court in New York, Mitch McCann reports.
It took the Manhattan jury just over 11 hours to find the former president of the United States guilty on the 34 charges he faced. Trump left the courtroom and rallied against the judge and the entire court process, calling it a disgrace and a rigged trial with a corrupt and conflicted judge. Trump told reporters, "I'm an innocent man. I'm fighting for our country." Day two of deliberation started with Judge Merchan rereading his jury instructions after the jury had asked him to do so, as well as the panel hearing testimony again from two key witnesses. The verdict is a historic moment in American history. Trump is the first former president to be convicted of a crime, and he'll be sentenced this coming July. Mitch McCann, New York.
The panel deliberated for more than 4 hours Wednesday and asked the judge to rehear both jury instructions and portions of testimony from two key witnesses, former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker and Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen, whose testimony Trump's lawyer sought to derail, painting him as a liar who had been incarcerated for lying to authorities. Prosecutors say Trump falsified internal business records to cover up hush money payments tied to an alleged plan to buy and bury stories that could sabotage his 2016 White House bid. Trump has denied any wrongdoing and pled not guilty to all 34 felony counts. He blasted the case ahead of jury deliberations today as election interference. This while he campaigns for another White House bid, calling the trial against him a Stalinist attack.
This Stalinist-like case is a Stalinist-like case. It has prevented President Trump from running for office. Has prevented him from campaigning. He's unable to campaign because he's been in a courthouse for 5 weeks.
Trump's son, Eric Trump, speaking outside the courthouse Tuesday, said they'll win the trial because they're white.
And I cannot wait for the day that we win. We will. We're white. The entire country knows that this is nonsense. They don't buy it.
Eric Trump told Newsweek Wednesday it was a slip of the tongue. He meant to say we are right.
Ahead of the 2024 election, an undercurrent of Christian nationalism is lurking. And GOP voters in North Dakota were recently polled about the dynamic between government policy and Christianity. The new poll from North Dakota News Cooperative found that 71% of Republican voters in the state feel that U.S. laws should be based on Christian values. Amy Jacobson of the watchdog organization Prairie Action feels some respondents are expressing their desire to have the core elements of Christianity reflected in how the government serves the public. But she worries politicians deemed extreme use these results to whip up constituents into a moral panic.
What is sometimes happening is that universal values of love and compassion and caring for our neighbor, Christian nationalists are trying to almost own that solely.
While respondents embrace these values being linked with policy, a smaller majority, 54%, say the U.S. government should be declared a Christian nation. Political analysts connect the movement's recent growth to white evangelicals and their support of former President Donald Trump. They define this ideology as being a real American, but opponents contend it helps fuel hate. The growing calls for Christian nationalism come despite the First Amendment saying the U.S. should have no official religion. If poll results like these pave the way for some sort of official action, Jacobson warns an enormous loss would be felt.
Religious freedom, that is probably the largest, because then we have a place where we're dictating our policies based on a single view of Christianity, which can be very dangerous.
The Center for American Progress warns that Christian nationalism can be used as a tool to scale back protections for LGBTQ populations, women, and religious minorities. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
The Supreme Court ruled unanimously today that the National Rifle Association can go ahead with a lawsuit against an ex-New York State official over claims she pressured companies to blacklist it following the 2018 Parkland, Florida school shooting. Justices wrote that the ruling was based on the First Amendment prohibition against government officials using their power to suppress speech. The NRA says ex-New York Department of Financial Services Superintendent Maria Vullo violated its free speech rights while investigating NRA-endorsed insurance policies. The Supreme Court ruling reverses a lower court decision tossing out the NRA's suit against Vullo. The gun lobby called the high court ruling a landmark victory. Vullo argues she rightly investigated NRA-endorsed insurance policies. Chief Justice John Roberts today rejected a request from Senate Democrats to discuss ethical issues on the court in the wake of Justice Samuel Alito's flag controversy, Sagar Magani reports.
The flags are like those carried by Capitol rioters. Two Senate Judiciary Committee Democrats asked Roberts for the meeting a week ago and wanted him to ensure that Alito recused himself from any high court cases concerning the riot or Donald Trump's bids to overturn his election loss. Roberts declined the meeting and noted justices decide for themselves when to step aside from cases. Alito told House and Senate lawmakers yesterday he will not recuse. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Congressman Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, says the Department of Justice could force Supreme Court justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas to recuse themselves from cases before the court pertaining to the deadly January 6th Capitol attack and Donald Trump's immunity in related prosecution. Alito faces calls for their recusal from the case over flags flown outside his homes associated with Trump supporters who stormed the Capitol on January 6th and associated with far-right Christian nationalism. Thomas faces calls for recusal for his wife's support and reported involvement in the January 6th deadly Capitol attack. Raskin, a constitutional law expert and professor, wrote in the New York Times the Department of Justice and Attorney General Merrick Garland could invoke two provisions in the U.S. Constitution to force their recusal. Quote, specifically the Due Process Clause and the federal statute mandating judicial disqualification for questionable impartiality, unquote. Alito was brushing off calls for recusal. Alex Gonzalez reports.
Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito says he won't recuse himself from January 6th insurrection cases, even though two flags connected to the riot were flown outside his homes. Tennessee Democrat Steve Cohen is leading a censure effort in the House.
Well, what he's done is contrary to his oath of office, it's contrary to what the role of a Supreme Court justice should be, which is to be impartial at all times and avoid even the appearance of impropriety.
New reporting from the New York Times cast doubt on Alito's story about a U.S. flag flown upside down at his home. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Lee today signed a bill designed to block adults from helping minors get an abortion or receive gender-affirming care without parental consent in the state. Both proposals are likely to face immediate legal challenges when they go into effect later this year. Lee quietly signed the bills Tuesday without comment. However, the governor's actions weren't unexpected. During his time in office, Lee has enacted sweeping restrictions on gender-affirming care for young people and has defended Tennessee's near-total ban on abortion while stressing his opposition to the procedure. Both laws are set to go into effect July 1st.
South Dakota's Secretary of State received more than enough signatures to get a decision on abortion rights on the November ballot, but some of those signees are now getting calls to rescind their support. South Dakota currently outlaws all abortions except those to save the life of the mother. Secretary of State Monet Johnson recently validated a citizen ballot initiative to enshrine some protections to abortion in the state's constitution. The state is one of 19 that has a direct citizen initiative process, but it might be the only one where initiative signatures can be removed. That's due to a new law passed this spring with an emergency clause that Samantha Chapman with the ACLU of South Dakota says was designed to block abortion access.
Every single committee hearing that was had on this bill, the discussion was almost entirely and solely about this one singular abortion rights ballot measure, even though the law would obviously affect all ballot measures.
The prime sponsor of the bill, Del Rapids Republican Representative John Hansen, is also behind a new political action committee, South Dakota Petition Integrity, which began making calls to signers of the abortion initiative before the group was registered with the state, leading Secretary of State Johnson to release an official warning of potential scams. Paid ballot circulators who collected signatures for the abortion rights initiative had to apply and register with the state and carry a badge with an ID number. To rescind a signature, a signer must send a notarized letter to the state. But there are no requirements for people asking signers to rescind their signatures.
There's so many requirements that petition circulators have to adhere to. And so there's not the same level of scrutiny and standards that are applied to the reversal of your signature.
According to the Secretary of State's website, the office does not track how many signatures have been rescinded, but makes that information available to parties involved in any court challenge. I'm Kathleen Shannon reporting for Greater Dakota News Service.
Louisiana's Republican Governor Jeff Landry today signed a bill into law that sets up a 25-foot buffer zone around police officers who are working. The bill would fine a person up to $500 or up to 60 days in jail or both if they approach an officer after being told to stand or move back while that officer is performing his or her duty. Critics of the law say it could hinder people who are trying to record an incident, which is seen as a tool for holding officers to account. Some critics have argued it could interfere with a person's First Amendment rights. Bystander videos have been credited with revealing police misconduct, particularly the 2020 Minneapolis police killing of George Floyd. Backers of the Louisiana law say it's intended to give officers a safe distance to perform their duties without interference. A similar bill in Louisiana was vetoed last year by then-Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards.
A group of Texas Democrats are asking the Department of Justice to investigate Texas Governor Greg Abbott's pardoning of a man found guilty of murdering a Black Lives Matter protester. Daniel Perry was sentenced to 25 years in prison for shooting Garrett Foster, who was a U.S. Air Force veteran. FSN's Tony Waterman has more.
In a letter to the DOJ, the 14 attorneys general questioned Abbott's reasoning, arguing such self-defense statutes encourage vigilantes to attend protests armed and ready to shoot and kill. Daniel Perry was convicted of murdering Garrett Foster at a BLM protest in Austin in 2020 and was sentenced to 25 years in prison. Perry drove his car into the crowd, but claimed Foster, who was legally carrying an AK-47, raised the gun at him. Witness testimony was mixed on whether that actually happened. Tony Waterman, Texas.
According to the Black Vote in Pennsylvania Wednesday, President Joe Biden said if the deadly January 6th Capitol attack had been committed by African Americans, Trump would not want to pardon them.
What do you think would happen if Black Americans had stormed the Capitol? I don't think he'd be talking about pardons. It's the same guy who wanted to tear gas you as you peacefully protested George Floyd's murder.
He also warned the next president will be able to appoint a couple of new Supreme Court justices.
Tell me that won't change your life when Trump justices are already gutting voting rights, overturning Roe, decimating affirmative action, and so much more. We're going to let that happen? We can't.
An AP NORC poll in March shows Biden's approval dropped among Black voters from 94% when he began his term to 55%.
Nevada's early voting started this past weekend and will run through June 7th, with the June primary election taking place on Tuesday, June 11th. Melody Julilla with Silver State Voices says she considers Nevada to be what she calls a voter-friendly state, as it grants voters the option to either vote by mail or vote in person at a physical polling location, something that isn't the case in every state. She contends that Nevada's policymakers and election workers understand that voting is an effective way for Nevadans to make their voices heard.
these options are for voters who, no matter what they're going through in lives or what they're currently doing, right, this is really about accessibility.
Hudilia says there is also the effective absentee system for elections, otherwise known as EASE. It's a system that allows Nevada service members, overseas voters, Nevada residents with disabilities, and tribal members who reside on a reservation to cast a ballot electronically. She wants to remind folks that Nevada has a closed primary, meaning registered Democrats and Republicans can only vote for their respective candidates. Nonpartisan voters can only vote in nonpartisan contests. Hulidia says this year's election gets a lot of buzz because it's a presidential one. She says while it's an important election to participate in for that reason, she wants to remind voters that the ballot box is still one of the best ways to voice your opinion on issues that directly impact you and your community.
Housing affordability, education, economy, like the justice court system, right? All of those things are on the ballot represented by the candidates you select, right, or don't select for the primary and going into the general.
For a full list of early voting sites and polling locations, visit nvsos.gov. Hulidia also encourages Nevadans to check their voter registration at nvsos.gov/voter search and says voters can switch political affiliations using same-day registration at polling locations. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Advocates for Iowa's older population are calling on seniors to vote in Tuesday's primary election and have identified their priorities for candidates seeking their support. There are three ways to vote in Tuesday's primary. Voters can choose to cast a ballot by mail, vote early in person at their county auditor's office, or the old-fashioned way, by going to polling places and filling out a paper ballot on election day. Whatever method they choose, AARP Iowa's Brad Anderson says there's power in numbers for the state's older voters.
One thing we know for sure is that older voters will dominate the overall turnout. During the last primary election in 2022, 77% were 50 or older.
Anderson says because Iowa's older voters turn out in high numbers at the polls, AARP is telling candidates exactly what's important to the state's seniors and what it takes to win their support. He says retirement and health care related issues top the list. Anderson says that's why the group has laid out a list of priorities for the candidates, reminding them that 3 out of 4 voters in Tuesday's primary will be 50 or older, and that their votes could decide the election.
Older voters care deeply about the future of Social Security. They also care about Medicare and making sure Medicare is intact. And then finally, they care deeply about lowering the cost of prescription drugs.
Anderson says despite recent steps taken as part of the Inflation Reduction Act to reduce the prices of some prescription medications, cost remains a hurdle for many Iowans. The polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Tuesday. This is Mark Moran for Iowa News Service.
As the state of Arizona grapples with a $1.8 billion budget deficit, public school advocates are demanding urgent reform on the state's Empowerment Scholarship Account Voucher Program, which lets parents use public funds for private school tuition and other education-related costs. Democratic Representative Annalise Ortiz says the Republican majority is hell-bent on privatizing education and profiting off the backs of Arizona children.
The fraud and abuse of ESA vouchers is infuriating, especially considering the massive unmet needs of the 90% of families who choose Arizona public schools.
Ortiz says every new ESA voucher subtracts funding from Arizona's public schools, which are funded 49th in the nation, according to the Education Law Center. ESA vouchers will cost the state an estimated $825 million in fiscal year 2024, according to the nonpartisan organization Save Our Schools Arizona. And while the numbers tell one story, Republicans in charge of the state's Department of Education contend the ESA program saves taxpayers money while giving parents more options. Save Our Schools has collected over 3,000 signatures from Arizonans that want ESA voucher reform. Executive director of the group, Beth Lewis, says the signatures, delivered to lawmakers on Wednesday, represent the majority of Arizona voters who want ESA vouchers to be accountable and want public school funding to be prioritized.
Our state legislature has a clear choice: make devastating cuts to our local public schools and essential services, or B, work with Governor Hobbs to rein in this irresponsible, out-of-control voucher program and return public funds to our schools.
Lewis argues that a budget without a voucher reform is no budget at all, especially as teachers continue to struggle to afford basic classroom supplies across the state. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
The Commerce Department said today that the U.S. economy grew at just 1.3% annual pace from January through March, the weakest quarterly rate since the spring of 2022. The government report showed it as a downgrade from its previous estimate, Consumer spending rose, but at a slower pace than previously thought. That's a sign that high interest rates and lingering inflation are pressuring household budgets. The Commerce Department had previously estimated that the nation's gross domestic product, that's the total output of goods and services in the country, expanded at a 1.6% rate last quarter. The first quarter's GDP growth marked a sharp slowdown from the vigorous 3.4% rate in the final 3 months of last year.
Environmental groups want to reduce shipping emissions at ports in Virginia and nationwide. They want President Joe Biden to sign an executive order decarbonizing maritime shipping and offer recommendations on best practices. International shipping accounts for 3% of global greenhouse gas emissions, but the International Maritime Organization wants international shipping to reach net zero emissions by 2050. Antonio Santos with Pacific Environment says one recommendation is having ships at anchor only use shore power.
That they effectively not use their auxiliary engines, as diesel engines, that they're plugged in either to shore power, right? And shore power is the connections where ships can use onshore electrical power instead of their auxiliary engines.
Other recommendations include establishing a goal-based fuel standard for ships using U.S. ports and supporting shipbuilders and maritime stakeholders to build low and zero emission ships. Santos says this could all be in place by 2040. The Biden administration has already begun work to decarbonize shipping no later than 2050 through the Ocean Climate Action Plan. Technologies to decarbonize ships are already in the works, albeit at a much smaller scale. Famous boats such as the Maid of the Mist and Niagara Falls went electric in 2020 with little issue. But Santos finds electrification isn't the best way forward for cargo ships. He says other clean fuels will be sought out.
Bigger ships, of course, because of the weight of the batteries, not a likely big player in the long-term solutions, which is why they're looking at some of these other fuel options like ammonia and hydrogen, whether that's burned in an internal combustion engine or used in a fuel cell.
Decarbonizing shipping can improve health outcomes in port communities. A National Institute of Health report shows the highest air pollution concentrations were along major shipping routes. Other studies show 400,000 premature deaths per year worldwide are attributed to air pollution from shipping. This is Edwin J. Vieira for Virginia News Connection.
The U.S. Department of Labor has filed a lawsuit against Hyundai Motor, claiming the South Korean auto giant illegally used child labor in Alabama. An auto parts company and a recruiting firm were also named in the suit. Tony Waterman has more.
The lawsuit comes after an investigation by the Labor Department found that a 13-year-old worked up to 60 hours a week on an assembly line, operating machines that formed sheet metal into auto body parts. According to the filing, the child was recruited by Best Practice Service and worked for the parts company Smart Alabama. Those parts were then used by Hyundai. The solicitor of labor said companies cannot escape liability by blaming outside companies for child labor violations. In a statement, Hyundai said child labor is inconsistent with its values and that the Labor Department is using an unprecedented legal theory to hold it accountable for other companies' actions.
San Jose State University professor who acted as a liaison between pro-Palestinian campus protesters and campus administration was suspended and is under investigation for disciplinary action. Justice Studies professor Song Keel, who has been at the university 17 years, said that on May 24th she received an email that accused her of violating the collective bargaining agreement. In a letter from Joanne Wright, the school's senior associate vice president of university personnel, it said that Dr. Keel is accused of, quote, repeated violations of university policies, including encouraging students to violate policies. Keel claims she was denied due process.
Israeli strikes in Gaza have killed 53 Palestinians in the last 24 hours and wounded more than 350, according to Gaza's health ministry. Among the dead, two paramedics with the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, which says the strikes were targeted as the paramedics were in a clearly marked ambulance. A ceasefire resolution is before the United Nations Security Council once again, this time by Algeria, calling for the immediate release of hostages in Hamas captivity since its October 7th attack, which spurred Israel's war in Gaza. Palestine's representative urged the council to pass the resolution, which also calls for an immediate cessation of hostilities in Rafah. Israel's representative said the war could end immediately if Hamas surrenders and releases all hostages.
The Israeli military today said it seized control of the Gaza side of the Egypt-Gaza border, where it said it discovered several cross-border tunnels used to smuggle weapons into the enclave. More from Joseph Fetterman.
This is known as the Philadelphia Corridor. It runs the entire length of the border. That's about 14 kilometers or 8 miles in length. It's important because Hamas, for years, has smuggled weapons through underground tunnels from Egypt into Gaza. Israel says it has discovered 20 tunnels during this current operation. It's not saying whether the tunnels are still operational, but it does say that controlling the stretch of land will put pressure on Hamas as it presses ahead with this offensive in Rafah. Now, the Rafah offensive began early this month. This is considered to be Hamas's last major stronghold in Gaza. The offensive is expected to last for some time. In fact, Israel's national security advisor is warning that the war throughout Gaza, not just Rafah, but all of Gaza, is expected to last throughout the year. He is calling 2024 a year of war.
And that's Joseph Fetterman.
The United Nations has paid tribute to Iran's president at a special ceremony in New York on Thursday. Ibrahim Raisi and his foreign minister were killed in a helicopter crash earlier this month. Ever since Jody Jacobs reports from the UN headquarters in New York.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres paid homage to Ibrahim Raisi at a special event in the General Assembly Hall. Guterres said Raisi led Iran at a challenging time not only for his country, but the region as a whole. Protesters gathered outside the UN headquarters as the event took place, saying it is shameful that the world body is paying tribute to Raisi. The US and Israel did not attend the ceremony. The US mission in a statement saying Raisi was involved in numerous horrific human rights abuses. The Iranians at the UN described Raisi as a dedicated leader, widely respected for his tireless efforts to foster good neighborliness.
President Biden has given Ukraine the green light to use U.S.-supplied weapons to strike inside Russia for the purpose only of defending the beleaguered city of Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city. Simon Marks reports on Ukrainian calls for the rules to be loosened.
President Volodymyr Zelensky wants his forces to be able to target Russian military facilities on Moscow's side of the border. In an interview with The Economist newspaper, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says he thinks the issue needs a second look.
If you deny Ukraine the right to hit military targets on Russian territory, then you make it very hard for them to uphold the right for self-defense. This is self-defense.
More of that at economist.com. The Biden administration has traditionally said it fears the risk of escalating conflict with the Kremlin, and Vladimir Putin again inferred this week that he would consider densely populated Western cities possible targets for reprisals if the US-supplied munitions are used to attack Russian soil. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
A court in Hong Kong has convicted 14 democracy leaders on subversion charges. The verdict in the long-running national security trial of a group of pro-democracy figures known as the Hong Kong 47 is the largest and most significant verdict following Beijing's national security crackdown. Laura Westbrook's reporting from outside court in Hong Kong.
14 of the accused have been found guilty. These include former lawmakers Helena Wong, and two have been acquitted. And these are known as the Hong Kong 47. They were accused of conspiracy to commit subversion, which was took place in 2020. For this unofficial primary that went ahead in that year, Beijing and the government warned lawmakers and people who took part in this primary at the time that this could contravene the national security law that Beijing imposed in 2020. That unofficial primary went ahead and 47 people were arrested. This trial has been a very long-running trial. This verdict's come in 6 months after the trial finished.
Hackers have allegedly stolen personal details of more than half a billion Ticketmaster customers and are demanding a $500,000 ransom payment. FSN's US correspondent Kate Fisher reports.
The Shiny Hunters hacking group has reportedly stolen the names, addresses, phone numbers and the partial payment details of 560 million Ticketmaster customers worldwide. The Australian government said it was aware of the breach and it's working with the online giant. The FBI has offered its assistance to Australian authorities.
A weather station in India's capital, New Delhi's, recorded an all-time high temperature of 52.9 degrees Celsius as the country's north and western regions continue to grapple with a severe heat wave. From New Delhi, Priyata Brajavasi.
India's weather agency says the temperature of 52.9 degrees Celsius was an outlier compared to other stations in the city, which had recorded temperatures ranging from 45.2 to 49.1 degrees Celsius in different parts of Delhi. As temperatures soar, the local government in Delhi says it's planning to ration water pressure to the city of 30 million people. It says it's taking a slew of measures such as reducing supply of water trucks from twice daily to once a day in some residential areas. It also warned residents against water wastage. Construction workers have been asked to take a paid break from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. until the mercury drops below the 40 degrees Celsius mark. Delhi Heat Action Plan includes sprinkling roads with treated sewage water and using sprinklers from high-rise buildings.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
I'm Max Pringle.
In Washington, I'm Kate Fisher.
In Washington, I'm Nick Harper.
In London, I'm Ollie Barrett.
KRFP, Moscow.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. An Ada County jury has found Chad Daybill guilty of all charges, including first-degree murder, in connection with the 2019 deaths of his wife's children, 16-year-old Tylee Ryan and 7-year-old J.J. Vallow, plus his ex-wife Tammy Daybill. The jury also convicted Daybill of insurance fraud in connection with the deaths. A jury last year convicted Chad Daybill's wife and the mother of the two children, Lori Vallow, of the murders, which likely happened near Rexburg. Police found the bodies of the two children buried on Chad Daybill's property at Rexburg. Chad Daybill now faces the death penalty. Judge Stephen Boyce told the jury they will stay sequestered during the sentencing phase as they deliberate the death penalty.
The state has the burden of proving the existence of a statutory aggravating circumstance, and that burden remains on the state throughout the sentencing phase. The defendant is not required to prove the absence of any aggravating circumstance, nor is the defendant required to produce any evidence at all. The state must prove the existence of a statutory aggravating circumstance beyond a reasonable doubt.
Speaking of the guilty parties, J.J. Vallow's grandfather, Larry Woodcock, said outside the courthouse, "What did they accomplish? What did they do? They destroyed families." According to the Idaho Press, Woodcock also thanked the jury. He said, "I'm happy it's over, and it's 99.9% over. There's one stage left, and I will say this, whatever verdict, whatever sentence the court and the jurors decide on, I will absolutely live with it. I want to thank the jurors. I hope they get help if they need it. They've heard and seen things that they can't unhear and can't unsee." During the murder trial of Lori Vallow last year, the prosecutor told the jury about Vallow and Chad Daybill's extreme religious beliefs, which include the pair claiming they can tell if people are possessed by dark spirits, and some of the possessions could turn the person into a zombie whose soul could only be saved by killing the person's body. Author and reporter Leah Satile, who wrote the book When the Moon Turns to Blood, Lori Vallow, Chad Daybill, and A Story of Murder, Wild Faith, and End Times, said after reading most of Chad Daybill's books that Chad Daybill is a believer in the White Horse Prophecy, which is portrayed as Mormon fringe, but has actually been mainstreamed in Mormon circles. Leah Satile, who produces the podcast Bundyville, took an interest in the Vallow Daybill case when she began getting messages to look into the White Horse Prophecy, which was viewed as a fringe cult of the Mormon Church. The White Horse Prophecy says Joseph Smith had told somebody the Mormons would save the United States and the Constitution from ruin. The Mormon Church denies the prophecy is real, Satile told The Inlander in 2022, after I came out with the first season of Bundyville, where we talked about that. I got a lot of emails from people who are like, yeah, it's not as fringe as you think. Like, I'm hearing about that in church. I've heard about it from my bishop. It's less fringe than you think. And I was like, oh, okay, noted. Satile said she has read almost all of the many books Chad Daybill wrote before marrying Lori Vallow. The books were sold mainly in Mormon bookstores, and over time, the writer became more obsessed with the end times. He created his own publishing house after writing for a mainstream Mormon publisher, and his books showed he saw threats from left-leaning political groups, God's judgment waiting in the wings, and he saw himself as a prophet. At the nation's capital, Republican U.S. Senator Steve Daines of Montana has blocked the Biden administration's nomination of Dana Jackson to be the first federal judge in Montana that's Native American. Jackson is the tribal attorney for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, headquartered in Pablo, Montana. Daines did not return what's called a blue slip on the Jackson nomination to the Senate Judiciary Committee. U.S. senators from the state where a judicial nominee would work get the blue slips, with the idea that they get to express priority opinions on the nomination, and generally the Senate will not approve judicial nominees unless both U.S. senators from the state they're from support the nominee. Daines spokesperson Rachel Doomke told the state's newsroom in an email the senator blocked the confirmation because the Biden administration did not consult with him prior to the nomination, which occurred April 24th. Doomke said Senator Daines believes confirming federal judges with lifetime tenure is among the most important decisions he will make, and that these individuals must be trusted to not legislate from the bench and protect the Montana way of life. White House Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates told the state's newsroom, representatives from Daines' office interviewed Jackson late last year, but Senator Daines himself refused to meet with her. Bates said, this claimed lack of consultation seems to be little more than a pretext, and it's shameful that Senator Daines is depriving Montana of the talents of a principled, fair, and impartial jurist like Dana Jackson, who would make history as Montana's first Native American federal judge. The other U.S. senator from Montana, Democrat John Tester, supports Jackson. Tester issued a statement in late April saying, as a born and raised Montanan, her extensive experience at every level of Montana's legal system makes her well qualified to serve our state, and I'm looking forward to getting her nomination across the finish line with bipartisan support in the Senate. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is sponsored by Spectrum 2 Art and Dance Studios, specializing in art and dance classes for child
through adult. 525 South Main Street in Moscow. Information at 208-882-1445, UBU Dance Guru at msn.com, or spectrum2studio.com. For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.
Get out. The vote advocates in Montana are spending more time and money than ever to get young people educated about the elections and get them to the polls. In Montana, young voters make up more than a quarter of the electorate. Nationwide, 63% of rural youth, or about 30 million people, are either infrequent or uncommitted voters. And of all the country's voter demographics, people younger than 35 are the most undecided. In Montana, young voters make up 28% of the state's electorate, but turn out in lower numbers than older voters. Kirsten Ewe with Forward Montana says organizers are trying to change that by mobilizing voters younger than 35 in small towns and rural areas.
We are registering voters. We are calling them. We will be knocking on doors. We'll be hosting events and candidate forums to really build a lot of energy and excitement.
Ewe says Montana's sheer size presents obstacles to voting, including for young people, so the Rural Youth Voter Fund is working to bring young people from rural areas together to discuss things such as health care, economic well-being, reproductive rights, climate, and education. Ewe says while it's not something people tend to think of as a problem, young rural Montanans are also facing a housing shortage that can cause additional obstacles to voting.
And that's really impacting people's abilities to not just live here, but also like when they'll get their ballot and if their ballot will actually be mailed to them.
Rural Democracy Initiative has created an online dashboard to help people determine what rural really means. It provides county-by-county data on demographics and other key election issues. This is Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection.
Multiple middle-aged men engaged in racial harassment against Native American children on a field trip to McEwen Park in downtown Coeur d'Alene Friday. That's according to a press release from the Coeur d'Alene tribe. According to reports, the men told the 11 and 12-year-olds to go back to the reservation while imitating feathers behind their heads and laughing. Coeur d'Alene Tribal Chair Chief James Allen issued a statement saying, "This pathetic, ugly display of disrespect and harassment occurred in the center of a busy public space in broad daylight. We are not going to sit back and watch our community deteriorate into a place where people believe it's okay to treat people differently based on the color of their skin." The tribe is offering a $25,000 reward for information leading to the identification and conviction or civil judgment against the middle-aged men. According to the Spokesman Review, Coeur d'Alene Police Captain David Hagar said officers are reviewing video and attempting to locate witnesses. Chief Allen said telling native Coeur d'Alene children to leave is ironic because the area that is now the city of Coeur d'Alene was their home long before Europeans came to the area. Allen said, "Coeur d'Alene is our homeland and our people have always been here and always will be." He also called on community leaders to join him standing up to bigotry and racism. Allen said, "We are all neighbors, brothers and sisters who deserve love and respect. The Coeur d'Alene tribe has always been a good neighbor." Coeur d'Alene Mayor Jim Hammond said in a phone interview with the Spokesman Review, "It's totally heartbreaking and totally unacceptable. There ought to be some kind of consequence for people who are that disrespectful." "Often there is not. The area has a history of failing to adequately confront bigotry and racist intimidation. Just this month, prosecutors in Coeur d'Alene declined to file charges against a high school student who police and witnesses say was one of several males who yelled racist slurs at the multi-ethnic University of Utah women's basketball team, cheerleaders, and coaches as they walked down Sherman Avenue in March. The incident made national news. Earlier this year, Judge John Cafferty in Coeur d'Alene dismissed conspiracy to riot charges against Patriot Front founder Thomas Ryan Rousseau, who Coeur d'Alene police arrested June 11, 2022, heading to the Pride in the Park celebration with a group of 30 Patriot Front members from all over the country who had shields, flagpoles, a smoke grenade, and a written plan to cause a confrontation. Investigate West reported in February the dismissal came after a year and a half of delays, lost evidence, and the failure of local prosecutors to follow court orders. A new University of Washington study has found the number of women from out of state finding abortion care in Washington has likely increased by 50% since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a woman's right to abortion in 2022. According to the study, out-of-state women accounted for 4% of abortions at Cedar River clinics before the Dobbs decision, and that number is now 6%. Cedar River clinics in Tacoma, Renton, and Yakima account for 15% of the abortions in the state. University of Washington Dr. Emily Godfrey, who is the study's senior author, said the influx of out-of-state patients does not appear to have impacted the level of care in the state. Godfrey told the Spokesman Review, "Patients are still getting appointments at the same rate that they did before Dobbs." Godfrey said she believes the data from the Cedar River clinics is representative of the state as a whole, but she plans to conduct another study that will include all abortion providers in the state. Compared to chemical abortions among out-of-state patients since the Dobbs decision has increased, she said out-of-state patients are choosing uterine aspiration procedures over medication abortion in order to be 100% certain that they are no longer pregnant when they return home, especially if they live in a state that now criminalizes abortion.
While Tillamook County, Oregon might be famous for its cheese, many of its residents struggle with food insecurity. The issue is especially acute in the summer when kids are out of school. Levi Johnson is the Tillamook Branch Operations Lead for Oregon Food Bank. He says the breakfasts and lunches some students receive at school can't be the only meals they get all day. His organization is working to fill in those hunger gaps during the summer.
We work with certain programs in our community. We call them summer feeding programs, where they're trying to set up distribution locations to provide free lunch to those students to help fill in that gap and that need to find a meal to get them through the day.
Food insecurity levels in Tillamook County are higher than the state average, at nearly 12%, compared to about 10%, according to the Oregon Hunger Task Force. Food insecurity is even higher for kids in the county, at 19%. The county is home to about 27,000 people. Johnson says the biggest barrier for residents is distance because of Tillamook's rural nature.
We have a lot of areas where to get to the nearest emergency food box site or even a meal site, they could be looking at a 30-minute drive alone, let alone a lot of folks that we serve don't have that kind of transportation, so they're either having to walk or bike.
Johnson notes people can find local food sites at OregonFoodFinder.org, which is available in 19 languages. He says the biggest challenge for food sites in Tillamook County is the need for more volunteers.
A lot of programs we've seen in the past few years close just because they're just not seeing the volunteers coming in to help them. And so we're trying our best to get more people involved.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell removed the city's police chief, Adrian Diaz, from his post Wednesday, but has not fired him from the department. Diaz had been police chief for 4 years. The new interim police chief will be former King County Sheriff Sue Rahr. There have been a number of allegations in recent months that police under the leadership of Diaz are unwelcoming and discriminatory against women and people of color. An outside investigator was reviewing the allegations, which Diaz vigorously denied. According to the Seattle Times, Mayor Harrell indicated the number of allegations were too much of a distraction. He said, "The people of Seattle should feel good about this move. We don't make panic moves. We make strategic moves." The paper reported Diaz choked back tears after his demotion. He said, "I've accomplished so much in the 4 years as chief, but there's more to be done." The new interim police chief, Sue Rahr, has spent 40 years in law enforcement and was elected county sheriff in 2005 and held that position until 2012. After serving as sheriff, Rahr became Washington Criminal Justice Training Commission director, and she retired from that role in 2021. As national outrage over the murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri spurred the Black Lives Matter movement, Rahr popularized the mantra of guardians, not warriors, when overseeing the training of police officers in the state. Rahr said, "I don't think the Seattle Police Department is worse or better than others. I think we have work to do in every department." Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area and the region, there is a frost advisory that's in effect until 8 a.m. tomorrow for the Washington and Idaho Palouse, the Central Panhandle Mountains, the Northern Panhandle, the Spokane area, the Upper Columbia Basin, and Western Okanagan County. Temperatures as low as 32 will result in frost formation. Frost could harm sensitive outdoor vegetation. Sensitive outdoor plants may be killed if left uncovered. A reformation of frost is expected again late Thursday night. Take steps now to protect tender plants from the cold. There's also a hydrological outlook that's in effect. Starting Sunday night, an atmospheric river will bring moderate rainfall, leading to rises on streams and rivers. The hydrological outlook is for Latah, Lewis, Nez Perce, Kootenai, Shoshone, Bonner, and Boundary counties in Idaho, and Chelan and Ponderay counties in Washington. Beginning Sunday evening along the crest of the Cascades and moving into eastern Washington and the Idaho Panhandle Monday evening. Moderate rainfall leading to rises on area creeks, streams, rivers, and lakes. Monday morning rainfall could be locally heavy, especially across Idaho. There is low confidence of the potential for isolated rock or mudslides. The rain will largely be beneficial to the parched region. Rainfall totals of 1 to 2 inches at the crest of the Cascades and the mountains of northeastern Washington and the Idaho Panhandle are currently forecast. And the forecast for the Moscow Pullman area is calling for patchy frost after 3 a.m. tonight, otherwise mostly clear, low 36. Tomorrow, patchy frost before 8 a.m., otherwise sunny, high 67. Increasing clouds Friday night, low 46, mostly cloudy, high 70 on Saturday. Mostly cloudy, low 47 Saturday night with a chance of sprinkles before midnight and partly sunny on Sunday, high 68. Currently 59 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscast you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. Or you can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Have a good night. We have flashpoints coming up, and that'll be followed at 7:30 by Appearing Locally, where we'll feature music from artists that are coming to the Moscow Pullman area in the near future. And at 8 o'clock, Maximum Rock and Roll. And at 9 o'clock, we'll have more music and entertainment throughout the evening. KRFP, Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is sponsored by Mikey's Euros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine, such as gyros, falafel, hummus, and tabbouleh, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.